Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Friday, March 29th. With us now, the renowned tech journalist, Kara Swisher, with her new memoir called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. It's kind of a love-hate story, really, I might describe it as, about the companies and devices we all use constantly but are alienated from at the same time, the tech moguls she has covered for 30 years who have powered these epic changes in our culture, and Kara's own changing views on the industry she's covered since the birth of the internet. Kara Swisher hosts the podcast On with Kara Swisher and co-hosts the podcast Pivot with her and Scott Galloway. She appears regularly on CNN, was a New York Times columnist, as many of you know, and founder of Recode, among other things. Kara, thanks for making this one of your stops. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. And most of my family is thrilled I'm here because they listen to you all the time.
Oh, that's great. Can I start with a story that some of our listeners may have seen in the New York Magazine excerpt from the book, in which you describe being a young journalist at the Washington Post like 30 years ago and being relegated to covering this new thing called the internet because the editors saw it as fringy, a low-impact beat. What year was that, and why were you more interested than your editors at the time?
It was 92 or 93. I'm trying to, I covered AOL because they actually had me do it because I was the young person on the staff. I was young, relatively young compared to everybody else. I think it was in my early 30s. And I understood this internet computer thing. That was why I was put on it. I actually, you know, they had interest in me moving into political area, but I liked business. I liked covering business. And I, you know, as you know, at the Washington Post, politics is the center of all the action there for your, if you're an ambitious young reporter. But I was super interested in digital right from the get-go. And it wasn't, I didn't think it was a backwater. I thought they were going to change everything. And so there was a company in the Washington area called America Online. And I that's the first company I covered. You know, at the time, computers were mostly around government contractors.
And yeah, we thought AOL was going to change the world at that time.
They
and
did.
Now we make fun of anyone who still has an AOL email address.
Yeah, but they did change the world. They introduced the vast majority of people, consumers, to the idea of using digital services. And they were the very first ones who commercialized it. They used to have a foam finger they used to give out that said, it's so easy to use, no wonder it's number one. And it was so easy to use. And that was a critical part of getting people to start to use the early internet. And now, of course, it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous in your life.
And that excerpt in New York Magazine includes a prediction you made early on, talk about changing the world, that apparently the Washington Post management didn't see coming and was skeptical of when you brought it up, that Craigslist would kill classified advertising in their newspaper and really all newspapers, just as a point of oral history. Can you tell some of that story?
Yeah, I think I had covered retail before I covered digital stuff at the Post. And I had seen how Walmart had come in, and there was a decimation of local retailers at the time. And there was things like Hechinger's and Woody's and things like that. And that really knocked a strut out of the economic underpinnings of the Washington Post, especially since Walmart, which was heavily technologically fast forward in terms of how to stock its stores. They didn't advertise because they didn't need to. They knew other ways of reaching customers. And that was a problem. And then I saw Craigslist, which was this digital classifieds, essentially. And it was at no cost to people, and it worked, and it was kind of fun. And if you remember classifieds from the old days, they were expensive. You had to deal with a difficult customer service representative much of the time. And most of all, they didn't work that well. They didn't work. You had to sit there and with your finger and go down the list. So a digital one, which is easily searchable and constantly updated with something and zero cost, was a much better thing. And when I saw it, I was particularly disturbed. I was like, this is a big business for the Washington Post. Same thing with news. When news became free online, even if you had to have differentiated news because you couldn't do things as usual. So all their economic, you know, all if you're thinking about like a stool, all three businesses were under siege by digital.
Yeah, and that was the tip of the iceberg, of course.
Sure,
or maybe from Silicon Valley's perspective, the tip of the spear that has landed us in the place we're in now, where the old business models for journalism are disintegrating.
Done.
So much to the detriment of local news and maybe democracy itself.
Yeah,
as verified, truthful information that now has to compete with rampant disinformation on social media and all of that. And you point to this quote, and we're going to play the clip, from Mark Zuckerberg from 2021 on Facebook's responsibility for fighting that. This was on a podcast from The Verge, and here's that audio.
When you think about the integrity of a system like this, it's a little bit like fighting crime in a city. You know, no one expects that you're ever going to fully solve crime in a city. You know, the police department's goal is not to make it so that if there's any crime that happens that, you know, you say that the police department is failing. That's not reasonable. You know, I think instead, you know, what we generally expect is that, you know, the integrity systems, the police departments, if you will do a good job of helping to deter and catch the bad things when it happens and keep it at a minimum and keep driving the trend in a positive direction and be in front of other issues too. So we're going to do that here.
Mark Zuckerberg there, oh. Kara Swisher here. Why'd you include that quote?
Because it was ridiculous. He doesn't, you know, he's actually being disingenuous there because he doesn't want to solve crime at all. He doesn't care if crime exists. He doesn't want to have a police department. And so a lot of these companies are media companies. They are media companies. And what the problem is media companies thought they were helpers of media companies when in fact they became media companies, except that they didn't take the responsibility parts very seriously, if at all, which means that they had all the benefits of media without any of the costs of media. So that was, you know, it's just such nonsense because essentially he owns the city, but he doesn't pick up garbage. He doesn't have street signs. You can't fire him. You can't get rid of him. You can't sue him. You can't throw the bum out. But he runs everything, and then meanwhile, he's decimated any other possibility of any businesses that would help a consumer in any way. So,
and that was shortly after January 6th. That was the context for that clip, talking about fighting disinformation. So what, if anything, are they doing differently now to fight disinformation in this year's presidential election cycle?
I don't think they're doing anything. I think they've cut back on content. They just have given up on it because it is massive. Look, in a recent interview, Elon Musk with Don Lemon talked about, like, okay, there's 100 or 20 articles in a newspaper and there's 5 million. Well, that's not our problem. Just because you want to build a business where you have 5 million things to deal with a day and take all the, well, in X's cases, they don't make money, but you know, in Facebook's cases, just because you build a business with that much scale, it's not our problem. You can't monitor it. But that's how they like to say there's just too much of it. Well, don't build a platform like that. And so what they're doing is cutting back because it is really hard to monitor and it's very expensive. And their businesses soon become not such good businesses if they had to really do the kind of monitoring that's required. And so they hide behind the First Amendment and free speech in order to abrogate their responsibility to keep it clean. And they won't do it until they're forced to.
Here's Ralph in Washington, D.C., who said he read your older book about AOL, America Online. Ralph, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Thank you for taking the call. And hello, Ms. Swisher. And yes, I did read your book. And when I read the book, I was employed at AOL at the time. I worked there for 20 years. And before AOL, I worked at Prodigy as a bulletin board manager, or what you would term as content moderation. If I remember correctly, in the book, you referenced the Frank discussion board at Prodigy and how I think that you termed that could have been the beginning of Prodigy's downfall. I was a supervisor, actually, of the team of board editors that did the Frank, you know, that monitored the Frank discussion board in the evening.
Sure.
And I can agree with you about that. I can give you actual, yeah, you were right. You weren't wrong.
Uh-huh.
What I wanted to know basically was what you thought about the fact that these companies like Facebook and whatnot have gotten to be just too big to do content moderation. I mean, you look at Facebook and they have billions and billions of members. We had trouble monitoring the situation at AOL when it was just like 6 million.
That's
so
right.
The thing about it is, so I just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, you know, that was a really interesting case because I can't believe you were both places. I mean, Prodigy, the joke I made about Prodigy was everything IBM knew about retail and everything Sears knew about the technology. But it was, you know, the idea was that that these laws needed to be put in place to protect them because people were libeling other people, et cetera. And so that was correct at the time. And I agree, the flood of this should have been anticipated and figuring out how to put things in place, which it's almost impossible when you unleash a flood of people to say whatever they want. I don't know the solution, and I don't think I know what it is, but I do know you don't create a business that creates this scale problem and then throw your hands up at doing something about it. And then meanwhile, guess who's the richest people in the world? These people. I mean, maybe they're not such good businesses if you have to run them in a responsible way. Maybe that's what's happening here. And so we allow them. It's like we allow like pharmaceutical companies or chemical companies to spew all their toxic waste into the body politic. And we have to pay for it. We pay just like the opiate makers. Like there's so many comparisons in society where we do stop these companies from doing things. And I'm not talking about excessive regulation. I'm talking about any regulation whatsoever. There isn't any. And the regulation that exists from the time caller's talking about, which was to protect them. The Communications Decency Act had in it the Section 230. And it was to protect them from giving them broad immunity for to be able to grow. And now they've got this broad immunity and they can't even be sued. So this is like the best racket. Can you imagine a racket like this? You can't be sued. You're the richest people in the world. You don't have to pay the true costs of your business, and society pays the price for you. I think, man, I'd like to get into that business.
Well, and Ralph, thank you for your call. Politically
you,
speaking, the Democrats seem to emphasize policing misinformation. The Republicans emphasize not centering free speech, maybe because their side is benefiting more from the misinformation. And really, nobody wants corporations in the interest of their profits to decide what political speech is allowed to appear on their supposedly neutral platform. But the social harms of disinformation are very real. So do you have an opinion on what the right balance is?
First, I want to push back on the idea of policing and censoring. First of all, it's called editing. Like, they need to edit. They need to protect. Like, you know, Rupert Murdoch got sued and lost because of Smartmatic, right? He got sued and he lost and he paid almost $1 billion. There are prices to doing your job badly.
But he's got a newsroom with journalists who he employs.
That's
right,
great, but this is
the caller, Ralph,
was
just making
thing.
The point about, like, anybody can go on Facebook, Twitter, et cetera.
Then don't have a business where this happens. This is the thing. I think we have to rethink what a media company is. These are media companies, whether you like it or not. TikTok's a media company. It has impact. Just because it lets anybody do anything, they're not a phone company. They're a media company. And they like to have you think it. And then Republicans throw around the word censorship quite a lot, especially for people who never shut up. And that's another discussion. But it's not censorship to say, these are the laws of, this is what we do. We do it all the time across media. And we talk about the idea of editing, the idea of responsibility. And immediately people go into this free speech dementia that is really kind of odd. And even, you know, even Zuckerberg, he's like, First Amendment. I'm like, the First Amendment says government shall make no law, not these companies.
Right.
These companies can do whatever they want if they feel like it. And they're not here to protect our First Amendment rights. They're here to make money off our engagement. That's what they're here to do. And to pretend otherwise is laughable. And that what they do is they cloak themselves in the First Amendment. They cloak themselves in free speech and then proceed to be hypocritical. Elon Musk is a perfect example. Some free speech, except the people that I don't like, and then I throw them off. Like, give me a break. I'd rather you sit down and stop talking about free speech, because they don't really want to protect free speech. They want to protect themselves and their interests, which I get, but I wish they would stop lecturing us, the rest of us, about it.
So
again, it's
that.
Government shall make no law. Government shall make no law.
Meredith in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, thanks so much. I just want to thank Kara for being the adult in the room and for calling on these tech companies to be responsible and be accountable. And I'm wondering what her advice would be to, you know, hold these tech companies responsible and accountable when so much of our activism and advocacy these days are, you know, on their platforms.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Isn't that interesting? You know, I think that's the thing. We're so reliant on these companies and giving them unlimited power. Guess what we have? Elected officials that can do something about it. Just the other day when Mark Zuckerberg was appearing in front of Congress, where Senator Hawley asked him to apologize to these families whose kids had been hurt because of online, they were blaming for suicides and different things that had happened to them. And he asked him to turn around and apologize to them, which he should do, by the way, and he didn't, FYI. He just said, I'm sorry for what's happened to you, which is not an apology. That aside, I literally wanted to turn the camera around and say, you need to apologize to these families for never doing something about it. Instead, you're a cosplaying, attention sponge who can't
You're talking about the senator.
Hawley, yes, all of them, him in particular, because he forcing someone to apologize when you should be sorry yourself, you've never passed a law. Give me a break. These regulators work for us. These people, these legislators work for us, and they've done no laws whatsoever. They've done it in Europe. I just did a big interview with Marguerite Vestager, who they passed the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act. We haven't updated our antitrust. We haven't put in a national privacy bill. We haven't had algorithmic transparency. We haven't done, the list is long of the bills they haven't passed. So at this point, and, the government is trying, of course, with some of these antitrust cases, but they're woefully outmatched. They've taken away money from these organizations, and they've subjected themselves to lobbying on this stuff, and so I at this point our legislators should be the ones doing something about it, and we should demand that they do.
Hey, Kara, does Nicole Shanahan appear in your book? She comes out of Silicon Valley and is now Robert Kennedy Jr.'s running mate.
She doesn't.
Have you ever covered her?
No, because she doesn't have any companies of no. I'm sorry. She's not a technology person. She can say she is, but I'm more of a technology person than she is, or more qualified in that to talk about that. No. She married Sergey Brin, and she has a lot of money. And I'm sorry to say this, but that's why she was picked. She has a lot of money from a marriage to the Google founder. So
yeah.
Okay.
So
great.
Do you think the political media is mischaracterizing her when they call her a Silicon Valley figure?
She's there socially, I guess. Sure, she has a company. Sure, everyone and anyone can have a company in Silicon Valley. I've never covered anything she's ever made, and it's just she's not an entrepreneur of any status whatsoever. And to say so is laughable. I'm sorry, it's just not the case. She can say so, whatever.
Ron in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Kara Swisher. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Ouch, Nicole Shanahan. That was rough. I wanted to, Kara, to comment on another shipwreck that's the result of, especially with the emergence of AI, is the suck that it's making on energy and these huge data centers consuming so much energy. It's reversing any gains we're making in fighting climate change. And that's it.
Yeah. I agree with you. This is like the computing power, especially around AI and not just that crypto before that. And just in general, a lot of these companies are actually doing some really interesting things around trying to figure out alternative energy things, largely because of costs, which is a good reason to do it. It just seems like good. But, Google had something cooling and heating from ground energy down below the earth. They've done solar. They've done all kinds of things, and so I think it's important to push them to do these things because this is where a lot of the energy is being used. If you really look where things, it's in places you don't realize, and so I think this is a perfect place for tech to innovate on, and they have. It's not entirely true. They haven't. Google was at the forefront of some of these things, but all these companies do know that they need to depend less on fossil fuels. A lot of them are working on as nuclear energy, and I actually find it fascinating. Some of these small nuclear devices, I know that sounds scary, but actually it's really promising, the safe use of nuclear power. And I know I'm touching a third rail, but it's true. There's a lot of misinformation about nuclear energy. And so a lot of them, Sam Altman is working on a company. There's some stuff around fusion, hydrogen. I've been talking to a lot of these companies, and there's all kinds of ways they're doing it. But I do think tech has been at the forefront of trying to do things there. So in this case, I believe they're a little more forward than other companies in that regard. But you're right. It is a giant energy suck.
How do you see AI overall as life-altering, era-altering, maybe even species-altering, as many people do?
Yeah, I think it just, you have to make a reductive, you know, that's the thing, it's so reductive. There is either going to, you have the techno-optimists where everything is up and to the right, and you know they're wrong because they were wrong the last time. And then you have the techno-decelerationists, essentially, who are like, it's going to kill us. It's, you know, I had one person call me that if I didn't stop Sam Altman, I guess physically, he was going to kill humanity. And that's the plot of The Terminator. I understand the scientists in The Terminator, which I enjoyed as a movie, but I think it's a complex subject. We need to have our regulators in place understanding the problems and come to global decision making on things like killer robots, drone armies. Like, we should be able to say maybe not so much on the killer robots, maybe not so much on creating, you know, dangerous drugs. And at the same time, say maybe we should promote drug discovery on cancer and things like that, and have the government be involved in it. I know government's a dirty word, but it isn't. It just isn't. You're welcome for the internet. The government did that. The government does a lot of good things. And it should be a partner with private companies, because private companies are more innovative by their nature, because they're pushed by profits, right? They're more innovative. They like the stuff that's going on. You know, here, let me give a compliment to Elon Musk, the stuff they're doing. And I'm going to give a compliment to Gwynne Shotwell, who actually runs SpaceX. Some of the innovations they are making are very important. That said, we shouldn't just depend on him and them, because we need a wide ranging number of companies. And the greatest strength of the U.S. is the bottom up innovation that we have to promote among our people. And across the world, it's so incredible what's happening, and we should be pushing that. And instead of letting large companies dominate everything, there's nothing good is going to be happening with large companies dominating. Just historically, that's the case.
On that duality you were just pointing out between, I can't remember the exact words you used, but tech utopians and tech, what was the opposite? We have 20 seconds left. Were you ever a tech utopian, as so many people were in the early days?
20 seconds. I was a Star Trek gal. I'm a Star Trek gal. I believe in Star Trek. I don't love Star Wars so much. It's a dark and dystopian vision of the future. I'd love, as Steve Jobs said to me in an interview, I'd like it to be Star Trek.
And there's a pro podcast host who knows how to do 20 seconds in 20 seconds.
Sorry, you want more?
No.
William Shatner rocks. What can I say?
That was a compliment. The renowned tech journalist Kara Swisher, who you can hear on her podcast On with Kara Swisher and the podcast Pivot with her and Scott Galloway. And her new book is called Burn Book, A Tech Love Story. Thank you for being so generous with your time and thoughts for us.
Great. Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.